Good afternoon, you're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. This is Little Atoms with Richard Sanderson and me, Neil Denny.
Today's show comes from the launch of the USIN Manifesto on the 25th of May at the Union Chapel. What you'll hear is the four speeches from the main speakers there and an introduction by the journalist Nick Cohen.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. May I thank you all very much for coming and welcome you to the launch meeting for the Euston Manifesto. Now then, since 9/11, but especially in the last 2 years, arguments on the left have not been conducted in the mainstream media or on the BBC. They have been fought out on the internet, and for that reason, most of the speakers we've got here tonight will not be familiar to you as, you know, talking heads you will see on the BBC News or here on the Today programme. They have taken their ideas and developed their ideas to very tough arguments on the internet blogs. So, okay, first of all, I'd like you to welcome Norman Jerris, who is the Emeritus Professor of Politics at Manchester University. Any of you familiar with the often very bitter but often highly illuminating and highly learned arguments we go on the net will sooner or later have stumbled across Norm's blog, which is in fact called Norm Blog. And he's going to be the first to speak on the aims of the Euston Manifesto. So if you could welcome him, please.
By one of those coincidences that don't mean anything, 70 years ago today, and I mean to the very day, the poet T.S. Eliot paid a visit to a small hamlet in Cambridgeshire. He took the name of this place as the title for the fourth of his four quartets, Little Gidding. What's that got to do with the Euston Manifesto? Well, nothing really. But in the way of these things, I went back to the poem just to have a look in case, you never know, I might find some other connection than merely the date. And what I came back to there were these lines. And to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. So there you go, that gives me somewhere to start from this evening, because I want to talk about ends and beginnings in both a public and a personal sense. The first of these, 9/11, September the 11th, 2001. It's a day imprinted on public memory indelibly, because the crime committed in New York and Washington, D.C., announced a terrible willingness of which few people previously had been aware, a willingness to use terror without limit for political ends, a terrorism, that is to say, unconstrained by any concern about the numbers of the innocent dead. That day was both an end and a beginning, because it showed, and to many of us showed in an instant, that the world was now different, dangerously so, and in a way not amenable to simple-minded responses. That brings me to a second end and beginning, and if I may have your indulgence for this, I'll frame it in more personal terms. It happened in the days immediately following 9/11. not just simple-minded, but cold, shameful, appalling responses to the crime that had been perpetrated, parading across the pages of the liberal and the left press. You know the terms of it: blowback, comeuppance. Yes, a crime, of course, but what? But a crime to be contextualized immediately, just in case you might be unaware that it wasn't the first or the worst crime in human history. This kind of stuff, I regret to say, was coming principally from a part of the left, and in those few days, 12th, 13th, and the 14th of September 2001, it became clear to me that this part of the left wasn't a part one should have anything, or depending on where you were at the time, anything more to do with if the left was to have a worthwhile future and merit anybody's support. Now, anyone who's ever belonged to anything, as we all have, a family, a group, a club, a movement, will know that this involves having some quarrels. If you're part of the left, then you have your quarrels. And having been a part of the left all my adult life, I've had my share. But some things you quarrel about other things you draw a line. Over 9/11, I decided the time had come to draw a line. A left truly committed to democratic values doesn't make excuses for terrorism, not at all, not ever. Terrorism is murder. There is no context that makes it okay. This is a simple principle, that you do not wantonly kill the innocent, embodied in the most basic moral codes of civilized existence, embodied in the rules of warfare and in international humanitarian law. The left paid a heavy price for its fellow traveling with, its justification and apologetics for the mass crimes of the Soviet Union in the 20th century, for another generation of the left to put its foot upon a similar path is not something any of us should look upon with indulgence. It's the place to draw a line. You make an end, and if necessary, another beginning. The left has to do better than that. Okay, now push the clock forward from September 2001. It's 2003. A number of people are blogging about the Iraq War. In my own case, this starts in the summer of 2003, but others have already been going a while, and more others are getting into the conversation with each month that passes. There are bloggers of the left who support the war. How's that possible? Support the war from the left? Well, it's possible because Saddam Hussein's regime is a murderous tyranny, as it's been said, a torture chamber above ground, a mass grave below, responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in that long-suffering country. That's how it's possible. Of course, it was also possible to oppose the war, even while knowing this, as did a number of the supporters of the Euston Manifesto. There were weighty considerations on both sides, and reasonable people could reasonably disagree about the prospects and the dangers, how things were likely to turn out, as well as about the alternatives to war and their likely consequences and dangers. But there's been another discourse of opposition to the Iraq war, starting with the banners and slogans on that Saturday, 15th February 2003, from which one would never have known what kind of a place Saddam's Iraq was. It's been a discourse of denial, evidenced by the numbers of those on the left unwilling to allow or even comprehend why others of us on the left supported the war, evidenced by a rancorous hostility towards the pro-war left, and most seriously of all, evidenced by the lack of interest in initiatives of solidarity with the forces in Iraq battling for a democratic transformation of their country, which itself was part of a wider lack of enthusiasm for the success of this enterprise because of its origin in a war led by George Bush. To those who now say, in response to the Houston Manifesto, that such criticisms leveled by the manifesto at a large part of the anti-war left are misdirected, that such criticisms apply only to a small number of people on the far left, I've got two answers. Have to be brief. One, this isn't true. There's a more forceful way of putting that, but it violates the rules of public civility. Two, that it isn't true has been documented at length. In any event, this takes us back to those shameful responses to 9/11 from which I started, because some of the themes of what I'm calling the discourse of denial in argument about the Iraq war are for their part shameful too. A tendency to go silent about, or at least to minimize, the horrors of Ba'athist Iraq. A manner of distributing blame for everything that has gone wrong in that country in such a way that the daily killing of civilians by so-called insurgents figures only as one of the lamentable consequences of coalition failure, and barely at all as the result of the actions of those who are directly responsible, as if they were merely a hive of bees stirred up and not people making choices. And then only the most grudging acknowledgement, if that, that millions of Iraqis voting for a different kind of future for themselves is a matter of some significance. One has to draw a line. This is not the authentic voice of the left, and it is not a voice which any self-respecting liberal would be willing to own. It is a disgrace to the best aspirations of the progressive and democratic tradition. So, some people, bloggers, the owners of other websites, trade unionists, other kinds of activists, some of us come together last May. We know there are others out there who share our sense of non-belonging to the left liberal consensus on these issues. We know because of the feedback we get. Thank goodness I found your blog. Thank goodness I'm not the only one who feels that this left doesn't speak for me. Any of the left bloggers within this sort of loose coalition can tell you how much of that feedback they've had. So we get together, we decide to produce a document setting out some general principles, some common positions. The Euston Manifesto steps out into the world. What it says, I hope many of you now know, and I won't try to rehearse it here, but thank you all for coming this evening. We need to insist that there is a different tradition which socialists and democrats and liberals can speak out for. There's been quite a chorus of voices these past few weeks saying that the Euston Manifesto is of no account, though a lot of the people saying so seem pretty animated about it. Well, we make no extravagant claims. It's a beginning, that's all. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, our next speaker is Shalom Lapin. He's Professor of Computational Linguistics at King's College London. He's not so much a blogger himself, although he contributes to Norm's blog to Engage, and his name keeps cropping up in a lot of arguments. And Shalom is going to talk to you about democratic renewal. Is it possible to get a new democratic left in Britain? So.
We live in interesting and difficult times, fulfilling the Chinese curse. The end of the Cold War has seen the collapse of traditional political ideologies and introduced a period of acute uncertainty and disorientation. It's produced a massive transition which have shaken the tectonic plates of the economic and social order that defined the post-war era. Much of the change that we're witnessing is the direct result of wrenching economic patterns, particularly globalizing economic patterns that have produced integrated world markets, shifting ranges of employment and opportunity that have destroyed long-established institutions that many of us have grown up with. The result of this kind of transition, which has repeated itself time and again in history, is invariably not only confusion, but fear, and the politics of fear is rife, both in this country and throughout the world. In large parts of the developing world, the failure of secular nationalist groups, the same movements that successfully fought for the establishment of free and independent countries and the throwing off of the yoke of colonialism, that saw their countries and their peoples through to independence, the failure of these groups to produce peace and prosperity for a variety of reasons, and certainly in general not to produce democracy, has produced a terrible backlash, an anti-secular and reactionary response in large parts of Asia and the Middle East and Africa. In a particularly acute form, this backlash has assumed the character of revolutionary Islamist movements which seek to establish universal caliphate. One of the oddest specters that we are witnessing now is that of a large part of the radical left and a not inconsequential section of the so-called liberal left embracing these movements, forming alliances with them, engaging in apologetics for them, and treating them as agents of anti-imperialism. The left that has engaged in this sort of behavior has effectively substituted the advocates of jihad for the working class, as the vanguard of the revolution. In doing this, they've exchanged the traditional politics of working class development and the struggle for working class rights that has defined the left for a politics of identity, cultural identity, ethnicity, and as a result has produced a new socialism of fools. Not a small part of the liberal democratic left, which claims to remain true to principles of secular democracy and liberalism, has for some reason chosen to indulge this pattern in perhaps a more nuanced but nonetheless still puzzling way. Over on the right of the political spectrum, things are not pleasanter in any sense. The deep sense of instability unleashed by the threatening economic changes that we are seeing around us has been skillfully exploited by the right in the service of xenophobia, racism, and hatred of immigration. Immigrants are the lifeblood of development of a healthy, pluralistic society. The source of cultural richness and development are presented as agents of chaos and disruption of cohesion. They are accused of stealing jobs and of ruining the social fabric. Where the radical left and the xenophobic racist right converge is in a fear, a pronounced fear of globalizing economic patterns and a retreat into protectionist and increasingly tribalist solutions. This is, in effect, a Luddite response. It's reminiscent of the reaction of agrarian romantics to the Industrial Revolution of the 18th century. It seeks to deal with change by suppressing it. The dalliance of the left with the romance of jihadist fantasies and the rise of racist tribalism on the right are threatening the very foundations of liberal democracy and the fabric of pluralism in Europe and in large parts of the West. In the context of integrated global markets, capital mobility, and all that that has produced, offshore movement of companies taking jobs, the rise of low-tax economies where governments run after foreign investment for the sake of sustaining economic growth, what have come to be the neoliberal juggernaut, the traditional instruments that social democratic governments, those governments that produced and fashioned and cultivated the welfare state, the traditional instruments that such governments have employed in the past, in the post-war era, to constrain the power of capital within a welfare state are no longer effective. The nation state is not an effective forum for controlling mobile, integrated financial markets. National labor unions, corporate regulation, redistributive tax systems, extensive, generous universal public services, all are increasingly difficult to sustain in an environment in which advanced digital technologies and free trade agreements permit companies to move production investment to low-wage economies at the flick of a switch in order to maximize profit. Labor enjoys no such mobility, and it has no advocates that can effectively resist these patterns. Social democratic governments, as a result, are discarding their traditional role as agents of progressive reform. Instead, they are now making increasingly pale and ineffective efforts and ameliorating the devastating effects of the onslaught of the neoliberal juggernaut in the public domain and in the workplace. And third-way politics, as it's been defined in Western Europe, is increasingly becoming little more than soft peddling of the resigned embrace of neoliberalism by defeated social democrats, passed off as progressive thinking. In order to renew the social democratic project, it is, in my view, necessary to reformulate it in international terms. Rather than imposing globalizing patterns through tribalism and protectionism, what a friend of mine appropriately formulated as the battle cry of the guerrilla gardener, social democrats should seek to harness these globalizing patterns for social benefit. An internationalized social democracy must seek to prevent the concentration of the new wealth generated by expanded trade and globalizing patterns in the hands of a small corporate elite. It must formulate global mechanisms for redistributing this wealth to workers, consumers, and farmers, wage earners, in a way that counterbalances the power of international corporations. It must seek to use this wealth to alleviate the poverty in the developing world, particularly in Africa. Rather than suppressing globalization, it's necessary to harness it in order to achieve the rise in the standard of living in those parts of the world which have been forced into dire poverty. One way to achieve this objective of an internationalized social democracy is to promote the creation of strong unions, democratic unions, in the new and emerging industries of the underdeveloped world. Organizing labor for collective bargaining in these countries will raise the standard of living where these industries take root. And this will, hopefully, if encouraged on a large scale, produce a gradual convergence in living standards in the developing world and the West, and allow for the emergence of a genuinely international labor movement, a democratic labor movement. It will also contribute to the democratization of the underdeveloped countries in which these unions emerge. The second instrument that an international social democracy can invoke in order to socialize processes of international markets, integrated markets, and globalization is to properly negotiate free trade agreements so that they become not simply instruments for opening up markets to international corporations. When such trade agreements are formulated also as means of social investment, the welfare state writ internationally, they'll require that companies entering markets for competition contribute to public services and the social infrastructure of the countries from which they profit. They will impose fair labor laws, equitable taxation on profits, and stringent environmental constraints as conditions for making money in the low-wage economies which they open up. Free trade agreements can also be used and should be used to cultivate democratic institutions and respect for human rights, and we already have a precedent for such a pattern in the case of the EU expanding eastward in Europe and the Balkans. In order for free trade agreements to be instruments of progressive social change and regulation, they have to be negotiated by governments committed to this new social democratic agenda, rather than simply by representatives of corporate and financial interests. You might ask where we are coming from, where the ideas and the principles that the Houston Manifesto has expressed, and some of the ideas that you have heard and will hear tonight, are coming from. In my view, we are not a new phenomena. We are a continuation of a well-established part of the political left, which has unfortunately been allowed to lay dormant in the past few years. We represent a progressive social democratic left that has been in existence for many years. It's the same left that has been superbly represented by George Orwell in his time. George Orwell, whose internationalism led him to Spain to fight the cause of the Republicans against Franco's fascism. Orwell, whose hatred for Nazism led him to warn of the danger of Hitler when many of his friends in the Popular Front were preaching appeasement and praising the Hitler-Stalin Pact. George Orwell, whose commitment to democracy led him to expose the horrors of Stalinism at a time when many on the left, even the liberal left, were engaging in appalling apologetics for Stalin and his crimes. Orwell, the social democrat, the radical social democrat who campaigned for workers' rights and a democratic free labor movement and social reform in an uncertain post-war world. That is a tradition that we are coming from. Those are the values that we represent. That is the general direction in the political map that we represent, and it has a long and honorable history, particularly in this country, in Britain, but in the West in general. Renewing the democratic left requires a robust defense of pluralist democracy and human rights as universal values that apply in all contexts. Orwell was not a relativist. He did not think that it was possible to treat Nazism or Spanish fascism as legitimate expressions of alternative cultures. This commitment to the universality of human rights and pluralist democracy entails standing against the purveyors of cultural relativism and the false prophets who peddle hatred of the West as ersatz revolution, as Orwell did. It involves a thoroughgoing rejection of the politics of tribalism and cultural identity as the basis of political action. It seeks a return to an egalitarian, class-based politics driven by concern for the well-being of wage earners and consumers, wherever they may be. In working for such a renewal, we are dedicating ourselves to reclaiming the left in the name of the commitment to liberty and social equality that have traditionally defined it. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Yves Girard from Centre for Professional Ethics at Keele University. Now, Shalom mentioned cultural relativism, which strikes me as absolutely important because that's the wiggle room that allows many people to get out of their commitments and their principles on the left. They say, oh, it doesn't matter, it's a different culture. It's okay for them to treat women badly or deny democracy. And Eve is going to combat that very false notion.
I'll do my best.
Go for it.
Good evening. Society, that's all of us, needs the left, needs the broad liberal left. What do we want a left for? Well, we want it because of the left's commitment to some profoundly important values. Universal human rights, including the right to free speech and freedom of thought. Equality, in some sense of that very complicated concept. Social justice, tolerance, rational inquiry and scepticism about received truths, the power of reason to bring about change for the good, openness to criticism, and of course, democracy. These are the values of the liberal left, and they're always hard to maintain. We all find it hard to live up to these values. And they're always under threat as well, from the right, of course, but also sometimes from within the left itself. And right now, it seems to be one of these times. Part of the left seems to have lost its enthusiasm for some of these values. And this shows itself in various ways, but I'm just going to focus on two of them, time being short. Firstly, the turn towards cultural relativism. And secondly, the readiness to use double standards. Cultural relativism is the view that we can't judge a culture. We can't judge its moral and political practices from the outside. The values and practices that a culture endorses are right for that culture, says cultural relativism. Even if we've got different values, we can't judge another culture with its sets of values from the outside. And in fact, nobody is in a position to say that one culture is better than another. That's what cultural relativism says. And I think it follows from that, that for cultural relativists, there can be no such thing as universal human rights. And that's because the idea of human rights just is the idea of rights that belong to each one of us, just because we're human. And they belong to us whether or not our culture endorses them. Even if our culture doesn't recognize the right to free speech, the right to equality, the right to life, nonetheless, These are rights that we all have. That's the idea of human rights, universal human rights. And I think for cultural relativists, we just can't accept that. So why do people become cultural relativists? Well, I think this is very often because relativism is thought to promote tolerance. And tolerance, of course, is a good thing. And that's why at least some people are really drawn to cultural relativism. But this is a serious mistake. Tolerance is a good thing. In fact, we could do with a lot more of it. But as a matter of fact, cultural relativism doesn't promote tolerance. And that's because some of the cultures which relativism says that we mustn't criticise, we're just not in a position to criticise them. Some of these cultures are themselves very intolerant. But according to relativism, we can't criticise them for that because we can't criticise cultures from the outside. And furthermore, the requirement that we should, all of us, tolerate all other cultures, this thought that we ought to be tolerant, which I endorse, seems to be exactly the kind of universal moral requirement whose legitimacy cultural relativism just denies. It says there are no universal moral requirements, so how can there be one to tolerate other cultures? That's why cultural relativism, in spite of the way it looks, can't support tolerance as a value. Furthermore, cultural relativism very easily morphs into cultural determinism, the thought that we just can't escape the cultures, the values of our culture. And so we end up by thinking that, of course, these other cultures, these exotic cultures, just can't sustain democracy. We can't expect them to sustain democracy because it's alien to their culture. And who are we to criticise their tyrannical arrangements? But this isn't true. Democracy is not the exclusive property of the West. And thinking that it is leaves the victims of tyrannies unsupported by those of us who have the good fortune to live under democratic rule and who can afford the luxury of thinking that tyranny is good enough for other people, because, of course, we can't criticise their cultures from the outside. What's more, the relativist ban on criticism of other cultures is often applied very inconsistently, so that cultural relativists often feel free to criticise and to support others in criticising Western values and practices, while objecting to similar criticism of more distant cultures. What effect does this have? Well, it has the effect of distorting our judgment because it grossly magnifies the misdeeds of the West, especially of the main targets, America and Israel. Now, a situation in which only the liberal democracies are up for hostile criticism is not one which will promote the flourishing of liberal and democratic values, the values, that is, of the left. And I think it's significant that there's a current claim among some people on the left that we can't and shouldn't expect countries in the Middle East, say, to embrace or to be able to sustain democracy, there being no democratic tradition in that part of the world. It's just not part of their culture, say the relativists. But think back to the time of apartheid in South Africa. I don't remember anyone from the left saying that we shouldn't expect South Africans to be able to operate a democracy since it wasn't part of their indigenous culture. Nobody from the left said anything like that at the time of the struggle against apartheid. Some people did indeed say these things, but they were, of course, on the right. And to hear such things coming from the left is something new and disturbing. As a matter of fact, the use of double standards on the left is much wider than just the area of cultural relativism. We can also see these double standards in some people on the left who do support universal human rights, but they regard Western failures to respect human rights as the only ones which really matter. And they reserve their most vituperative criticism for the flaws and failures of the West. Well, leave aside the implicit racism of this one-sidedness, this assumption that only people in the West are fully morally responsible for their actions. Leave that aside. This view also again undermines commitment to liberal democracy. It encourages an easy moral equivalence between perfectly genuine crimes over here, but lesser crimes over here, and equally genuine but much greater crimes elsewhere. And again, the principal effect of this is likely to be an increase in anti-Western rhetoric and a turning away, a blinding ourselves to the miseries of dictatorial oppression elsewhere. I suppose the most obvious example of this is the declaration by Amnesty International that the greatest attack on human rights principles and values in the last 50 years came from the countries involved in the war on terror. Now, no doubt these countries have done things which erode human rights. I don't wish to underestimate that. But this period, the last 50 years, which Amnesty International is talking about, is one which contains the Rwandan genocide, the Cambodian genocide, the ongoing massacres in the Sudan, which look awfully like genocide. And the sheer numbers involved in these terrible killings make the Amnesty International judgment just morally grotesque. And I say this with real sorrow, because Amnesty International is otherwise such an admirable organisation, of which I have been a member for a very long time. So I really regret this one-sidedness, these double standards appearing in so respectable an organisation. The prevalence of double standards in parts of the left constitutes a deep distortion in its thought. It results in biased judgments because it's driven by biased judgments, by a profound and damaging prejudice against some of the polities which are committed, however imperfectly, to the very values which we look to the left to sustain. These double standards are a moral and intellectual disgrace. The liberal left, the broad liberal left, can do better than this. We can all do better than this, and I very much hope that we do. Thank you very much.
It's been a pretty grisly time working in liberal media in London these past few years. But the absolute lowest point came when the leaders of the anti-war marches, who hundreds of thousands, maybe over a million people, marched with the morally affirming banner of Not In My Name, when the leaders of those marches denounced Iraqi trade unionists as quislings. Iraqi trade unionists, some had supported the war, some had opposed it. Once the war was over, they came out from the underground, they came back to fight, they came back from exile, and of course, what do you expect fascistic movements to do with trade union leaders? They were murdered. Prime among their victims was Hadi Saleh, who was, if you like, the foremost figure in the Iraqi trade union movement. And I still find it absolutely revolting that people who, in prominent positions on the British left, gave support to his murderers, and that there was no criticism of them at all, apart from people like me in liberal media. Our next speaker, Alan Johnson, is hoping to address the balance a bit. He's written a book with Abdullah Mushin of the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions. Hadi Saleh and the Iraqi Trade Unions. The TUC will be publishing it in the summer. Alan is also the editor of Democratia. I urge you to read it if you haven't come across it. It's by far the most interesting and serious web journal the British Democratic Left has produced. It's not a blog, it's a magazine on the net, and if you ask Alan afterwards, he'll be able to fill you in with details. He's also involved with the Euston Manifesto and Unite Against Terror, and it's Edgehill University, which I never heard of before. He said it's Britain's newest university, so perhaps I shouldn't. Anyway, he's here to speak to you now.
Thanks, Ned. So the train's left Euston, but where's it going? And what's its destination? In my 15 minutes, I'd like to offer some tentative answers for discussion. Some have advised us that we should just get off the train right now. Right in the Times, Danny Finkelstein praised the manifesto and its authors, but he concluded it was a gigantic waste of time and effort. Why? Well, he said the ideas were good, but the effort to save the left from itself is wasted on people who do not agree and never will. In other words, he was saying the left is finished. To pick up on Norm's image, he was saying there has been an end, but there cannot be a beginning. Now, I would be persuaded by Danny if two things were the case, but I don't think either are. First, if George Galloway really was, as his book says, not the only one. In other words, if Galloway's kind of left really is the wave of the future. And second, the Eastern Manifesto group could not point to practical campaigns inspired by its principles which prove that a different kind of left can exist, beyond cyberspace and beyond newspaper columns. Anti-totalitarian, democratic, liberal, egalitarian, and international. Let me take each in turn. Take Galloway. I wish somebody would. He says he's not the only one. Hold on. Bloody well is the only one. He's the only one who stands in front of the tyrannized Syrian people and says on state television, quote, all dignified people are very proud of the speech made by the president, the last Arab ruler, the fortress of the remaining dignity of the Arabs. He's the only one who talks about the newspapers and the news media being, quote, controlled by Zionists. Zionists, right. Houston can point to real-world campaigns inspired by our principles. In good part, the Eastern Manifesto emerged out of just such campaigns. This has not been well reported. Present company accepted, Nick. I think journalists are often quite a narcissistic bunch. They've stared into the pool of Houston and they've only seen reflected back. Or the journalists. But Houston was not only the creation of Nick Cohen, Francis Wayne, John Lloyd, valued and esteemed Comrade Thor. It's important people understand where Houston came from, because that might tell us something about where it might be going. The Houston Manifesto emerged in good part from campaigning activity of a new sort, developed by networks of a new sort. Networks that bridge cyberspace, the blogosphere, and the real world of parliament, trade unions, and civil society. For those willing to dig, at Norm Blog, Harry's Place, Little Adams, at Labour Start, Labour Friends of Iran, Engage, at Cohen, Francis Wayne, John Lloyd, valued and esteemed Comrade Thor. It's important people understand where Houston came from, because that might tell us something about where it might be going. The Houston Manifesto emerged in good part from campaigning activity of a new sort, developed by networks of a new sort. Networks that bridge cyberspace, the blogosphere, and the real world of parliament, trade unions, and civil society. For those willing to dig, at Norm Blog, Harry's Place, Little Adams, at Labour Start, Labour Friends of Iran, Engage, at Unite Against Terror, Democracy, and elsewhere, that's where the real story is. I want to talk a bit about those campaigns and networks. Yes, they're modest affairs. I don't want to claim too much for them. They're growing every day, they're effective, and they punch well above their weight. But they do signpost the future. They show us how we might take the principles of the manifesto off the page and start making them a force in politics. Now, I think David Clark has an article in the New Statesman today that says, you know, the Eastern Group aren't really interested in these principles that they outline. Well, I was there, and we are more. Let me take you into O'Neill's, which is the pub that we met in. Upstairs, by the way, not downstairs. We're around the table and so on, not sitting downstairs, which is when we discussed the manifesto principles of equality and development for freedom, Eric Lee of Labour Start was there in a personal capacity. Now, Labour Start organises global online campaigns in defence of workers' rights. Labour Start TV, Radio Labour Start. I could sit there and talk to Eric about a Labour Start campaign, global, network, wireless, but also with boots on the ground, if you like, for the workers at a palm plantation and processing plant in Sumatra. They'd been sacked for forming an independent union, forcibly evicted from the plantation housing, the children had been expelled from school, their leaders had been jailed. Labour Start was mobilising its global army, tens of thousands strong, to in their defence. Now the truth is, it's Eric Lee who's not the only one. When I sat in O'Neill's discussing the manifesto principles of no apology for tyranny, human rights for all, two-state solution, I could talk to Jane Asher, John Pike, Alexander Simonon, Dave Hirsch, all of Engage. Engage is another global network. I could listen as they talked about fighting the new anti-Semitism. I could listen as they talked about reversing the academic boycott of Israel. I could listen as they talked about the engaged delegation to Israel and the West Bank, where they've met progressive Palestinian academics, Brazilian universities, progressive Israeli and European academics, and we're now organizing a democratic engagement between those forces. When we sat in O'Neill's and we talked about the manifesto principles of opposition to terrorism and a new internationalism, I could talk to Simon Pottinger, Adrian Cohen, David T. Harry's place, Kitty Wake and others. After 7-7, those people organized a statement and a website and a network called United Against Terror. That statement was translated into 13 languages. It was signed by people from over 40 countries. And they now form a global cyber community, which has the potential, not the funding, for the appeal label, to take that power that exists on the net into the real world, where we can fight terrorism and the causes of terrorism from Tanya to New York, Baghdad to London, Amman to Madrid. We then link up with Open Democracy and Madrid 11, and that campaign has taken off even further. They're not the only ones. When we sat in O'Neill's and discussed the principles of democracy and democratia, I could listen to Gary Kent, Labour Friends of Iraq. Gary's just back from a delegation, which he helped to organise in Iraq, and I hope he'll address us all later. Labour Friends of Iraq didn't just criticise President Bush and call for the passing of prohibition on torture. It also worked with the UK Trade Union USTO to produce a toolkit for solidarity with grassroots Iraq. Labour Friends of Iraq didn't just pressure government ministers and the Prime Minister in the House of Commons to act on the defence of trade union rights in the new Iraq and on treatment of detainees. We also organised a solidarity campaign in the global labour movement in defence of Nasrat Ismail, an Iraqi Kurd union leader facing death threats from the so-called resistance. Now, all these campaigns, modest as they are, tell me it's far from a gigantic waste of time and energy, as Dan had it, to think of renewal of progressive politics. And the reaction to the manifesto, since the online launch, has told me the same thing. And I don't just mean the coverage we've received in the international media. I mean this. An Austrian NGO worker emails me. She's been working for years to support women's organizations in Iraq and Kurdistan. Dear Aaron, yesterday I came back from another amazing trip. We discussed the Houston Manifesto. Talking to colleagues, I could organise translations into Kurdish, Farsi, Hebrew, German, French, Polish, and Spanish. She's not the only one. I really knew it wasn't a complete waste of time when Iranian university students contacted me in great excitement. They're translating the manifesto into Persian, they're organising a discussion circle in Iran to debate the manifesto, and best of all, they have amendments they want to suggest. I spoke to Paul Berman yesterday, who's the author of a very important book called Terror and Liberalism. He said this to me: I know that in every country there's tremendous untapped labor support for our manifesto. I think that's right. Many people today feel politically homeless. Many feel that they've not left the democratic left, but part of the democratic left have left them. After all, what the hell are you supposed to do? When Seamus Milne opened the Guardian comment pages to apologists for terrorism, apologists for authoritarianism, and to members of the campaign to defend Slobodan Milosevic. What the hell were you supposed to do when Ken Livingstone decided to embrace the angry and misogynist anti-Semitic cleric Cora Darwin and began acting as his attorney? What the hell were you supposed to do when Michael Moore said the fascistic Iraqi resistance were the reincarnation of 18th century American revolutionaries and he bid them on to victory? What the hell are you supposed to do when Martin Jakes decides he's had enough of democracy and he now sees the virtues of authoritarianism and poo-poos the idea that freedom and democracy are universal values? Every generation, it seems, has to rediscover anti-totalitarianism for itself. So some questions and some answers. Question: does Houston have a final destination? I would prefer to say that we travel towards what the American poet, we're all talking poets tonight, Walt Whitman called democratic vistas. I think we should have had enough of glorious final destinations, don't you? I think ours should be chasing humanism. Humanism is bad news. I think ours should be a solidarity with the shaken by that century and its enormities which are continuing, of course, today in Darfur. But chasing and shaken we may be, but I think nonetheless we should be positive and principled, ethical and creative, practical and reforming. We have a rich heritage. Next year will be the 70th anniversary of the murder of the Italian anti-fascist and liberal socialist Carlo Rosselli. He was assassinated along with his brother Nello by Mussolini. Their gravestone reads simply, Carlo and Nello Rosselli, justice and liberty. For this they died, for this they lived. And they do live, those ideas. Justice and liberty for all. Surely that's the name of the Eastern Manifesto's desire and yours too. But we must add with Cora Rosselli that liberty without the accompaniment and support of economic autonomy, without emancipation from the grip of pressing material necessity, does not exist for the individual. It's a mere fantasy. So we must think of social justice, of no one left behind, no one. That is the social democratic system. Question, is Houston the only train going that way? Answer, no. Let's be clear. The decent democratic left organisations and individuals outside the Houston group dwarf Houston, thank goodness. But perhaps Houston can act, as Will Hutton wrote in the Observer, as a catalyst. Perhaps we can embolden people to stand up, to speak out. People have been curiously silent about their own core values. People who have been curiously accommodating of the reaction left. And Houston's ability to reach people who are not attracted by the older organisations, I think tonight is proof of that. What we do next, to be honest, is partly up to you. Question, what will we need on the journey? Massimo D'Alema is one of the leaders of the Democratic Left in Italy. He's now the Italian Minister of Foreign Affairs. He once said a modern left democratic politics should rest on two pillars. First, a vision of the good society. And second, an interest in, a faith in, and a determination to empower so-called ordinary people. We will need both. Without the clear sense of the good society, we will lack direction. But we will not journey far without an ethic of responsibility, of kindness among strangers, of fraternity, of strong cultures of mutual aid, and of faith in the capacity of our fellows. That's why we make a case in the manifesto for the centrality of free, democratic trade unions and other collective forms of popular organisation, for the importance of a public service ethic, as well as high-quality public services, for the democratisation of everyday life and republican virtues, for the imperative of a new global covenant and of international economic development as freedom. Now yes, we have not set out a range of detailed policies to achieve these goals, true. The first task is always to draw some sharp lines of political sensibility, if you like, of political morality. We plan to debate any number of policies within the terms of the values set out in the manifesto. Final question, will Houston succeed? Well, faced with that question, containing as it does the old dangerous yearning for a guarantee from history or the party or God, I'm going to turn to a comic tale written by Shalom Aleichem, the Yiddish storyteller. It's a story of the man who waited for the Messiah. It's only 60 words in this story, so don't worry. Here it is. Once in Helm, the mythical village of East European Jews, a man was appointed to sit at the village gate and wait for the coming of the Messiah. He complained to the village elders that his pay was too low. You're right, they said to him, the pay is low, but consider, the work is low. Hours of steady work too. Maybe the steadiest work. But unlike Shlomo Levin's villager, I think we can do more than just sit and wait for Messiah, don't you? Like Labour Start, campaigning for the evicted and jailed oil palm workers in Sumatra, we can do more than just sit and wait. Like Engage, fighting anti-Semitism, bringing West Bank academics and Israeli academics together, we can do more than just sit and wait. And like Labour friends in Iraq, defending the Iraqi trade unions facing death threats from fascists, we can do more than just sit and wait. So, come on, let's get to work.